Hello, I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Glad you could join us. It can be a pretty confronting thing to open a book and read a handwritten suicide note which begins, "After 4 years of battling this illness, I just can't take it anymore." But I'm very pleased to say the man who wrote that note nearly 3 years ago is sitting in front of me now. Graham Cowan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Graham has quite a story to tell, so stay with us for that. I'm also pleased to welcome another man who knows all about that feeling of utter despair and the joy of recovery, former leader of the opposition in New South Wales, John Brogdon. Hello, John.
G'day.
Graham Cowan's brought together the stories of people overcoming depression. A lot of them are high-profile people you know, former WA Premier Jeff Gallop, who was on this show last year, Olympic swimmer Petrea Thomas and painter Margaret Olley. You might be surprised to know they all suffer from depression. He's called the book Back from the Brink. But before we go into more of those, Graham, we should start with your story, because the one I was referring to with the note, this wasn't your first suicide attempt. Can you recall how bad things were for you in your early 30s when you hit rock bottom?
Yeah, still very clearly. It's a long time ago, but it's still quite painful. I'd had five major episodes of depression. The second one, which was when I was in my early 30s, was when I was married. I had a young child. I'd had a successful sales and marketing career, but I'd just taken a recent fork into a new area of recruitment, quite a high-stress area, and I wasn't excelling at it, basically. And so I started to feel stress. I started to feel anxious. I started to not to sleep. And I was still driving myself each day. Recruitment's a very sales-oriented business, so I was trying to be upbeat and positive all the time. And it just was gradually taking its toll, and I was wearing this mask all the time. I was feeling despair. And for some reason, I just couldn't reach out. I just couldn't go to a doctor and say that I was feeling bad. I told my wife I wasn't sleeping, but I didn't tell her the extent of my despair, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And it just came to the stage where, it does seem irrational and not logical now, but I really believe that it wasn't possible to get better. I really believe that there was no possible way of improving. And I thought that I just had this view that I was going to be a burden for the rest of my life to my family.
It's interesting, because at that stage, on the face of it, you had everything going for you.
Yeah.
Is your response a sick person's response, or a particularly blokey sick person's response?
I think there's a very blokey element to it. You know, I really felt that a man should be on top of things. I really felt that I should be able to handle this. I had been brought up to be positive. I'd been working in a sales area, which was a very positive area. And it was very blokey not to reach out. It was incredibly blokey. And, that I hope is a message to people out there, that just to urge them to reach out, because you can get over it, and I guess John and I are here to witness that.
Yeah, John Brogdon, you've been very quiet until now listening to Graham.
Well, I've known Graham for about 9 or 10 months now, in the early stages of him writing this book, and I don't know that I've ever seen him have to sort of tell that story. So it's not very easy, and I guess for people like me who are used to talking to journalists and in radio studios, it's easy, but watching Graham, it's challenging. But what is interesting, one point that Graham made, which is very similar, I guess two points that were very similar to me, is that externally you would look at Graham and say, married, child, successful career, branching into a new career.
All looks good.
Oh, fantastic. This guy's a superstar. And then Graham used the phrase of wearing the mask. And you do wear a mask. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about many people with depression, is that you get up and you, not so much to your family, because they see you at your worst, and friends, but when you go to work, you put on the mask, don't you, Graham? And you almost put on this suit. And
but particularly when your job is doing what you used to do, where it's constantly about controlling how you present.
That's right.
Staying on message.
Yeah.
Always appearing under control. Yeah. You can't have a glass jaw. You can't overreact. Yeah. So you're used to having an intensely controlled persona.
Yeah, and
maybe that makes it worse in a way.
It does, without a doubt, because it becomes a perfect way to keep pushing it away. I imagine Graham's experience would be that, you know, you sort of, because you have to keep going at work, and you've got a mortgage to pay, for God's sake, and you've got children, you know, and you've got ambitions and expectations of the future, so you've got to keep going. And it ends up being a great way of pushing it away. And for many people, they hit the grog. Big drinkers, because that's the way they deal with it. That terrible phrase. I mean, I never actually understood what the phrase self-medication meant, but it's people who, you know, who hit the terps or take drugs or in some way, you know, deal with that tension, that depression. Others literally go home and beat the wife or beat the kids. Others are just horrible people to be around. I mean, you know, they might be brilliant. They might be absolutely brilliant at what they do, but they're horrible people to be around. They're nasty, they're rude, they yell at people.
What did you do? Because you had this sort of stellar career,
yeah,
very young to get the job. We're doing, it's widely agreed, pretty well in it. And then, I mean, you've said that you probably had suffered from it for years and not recognised. How did it manifest?
Well, with me, it was behavioural. You know, I became completely driven. So I actually became irrational and imbalanced in a very quiet and controlled way, because people would look at me and say, oh, the guy's working his backside off. Isn't it fantastic? He's so dedicated. But I'd be working 6 and 7 days a night and 6 and 7 days a week and 6 and 7 nights a week. And if I was having dinner with you tonight and you rang up and said, listen, I'm sick, I can't make it, most people would say, fantastic, a night at home. Chance to see my wife or get home and or go and see a movie or spend some time with my family. I would turn to my personal assistant and say, listen, there's a group of journalists I need to catch up with. Can you see who's available for dinner tonight? I mean, it was this driven mania in one sense. I mean, I behaved poorly. That's well reported. I probably drank a little bit too much from time to time. I wasn't a closet drinker in any sense. And I treated people badly. I mean, I treated my personal staff pretty badly. I certainly, you know, treated those around me pretty badly. I look back at some of the instances now, you know, just catching up with friends and thinking, gee, I was hard to be around. And of course, if you'd said to me, and I'd be fascinated to see what Graham's view on this is, if you said to me, listen, I think there's something wrong, John, with the possible exception of my wife, who I think sat there in quiet despair watching it happen, thinking, how can I deal with this guy? You know, he won't think he's depressed. But if you had said to me, John, I think there really is something wrong, you need to slow down and check all this out and have a talk to somebody and maybe think about what's wrong, I would have brushed that off. I probably would have written you off. I would have said, who's that person? What are they trying to do to me?
Did anyone try?
It's funny you say. I look back at one friend who had a long-standing friend and worked for me for a period early in my time as leader of the opposition, and he came and went after he worked for me, wanted to sit down and say, there's something wrong. And I thought, you know, he doesn't get it. He doesn't get the pressures of this job. But he did. I didn't get the pressures of the job. And I think there are a number of instances where my wife, Lucy, sort of in little ways was just raising, you know, an absolute red flag and trying to deal with issues, but I was just too driven.
Graham, if I come back to you, you actually rang Lifeline after 3 suicide attempts,
yeah,
failed that night, and as a consequence saw a psychologist and found your way to treatment. But that wasn't the end of it, was it?
No, it wasn't. I was very fortunate that first time. I got to see a very good psychiatrist and I went on a medication and I responded very quickly. You know, I was back at work in 2 weeks' time. And things went on from there and I was able to live a normal life again, get back into the corporate worlds, you know, into all the activity. But then in 2000, I had what was by far the worst episode. It lasted for 5 years. I was clinically depressed for 5 years. I tried 23 medications. I was hospitalised. 23?
I did not know there were 23 medications.
There's quite a few there.
There's probably 46. Probably 230, yeah.
I was hospitalised 4 times. I had ECT 20 times. I tried...
That's shock treatment.
Yeah, shock treatment. I had cognitive behaviour therapy. I tried kinesiology. I tried acupuncture. I tried everything.
What worked?
Well, what I found was I went to a course where they encourage you to set short weekly goals across everything, across exercise, family, contact with friends. And I found that setting realistic goals, at first they were very modest. I found doing something each week and forcing yourself to exercise each day, I eventually got up to walking 40 minutes a day, and I do that every day now. I meditate now twice a day. I've got different priorities in life now. I was very focused on my career before, like John. I really had that as my first priority, if I'm really honest. Now I put my personal health first, my exercise, my meditation. Second priority, I put my relationships with my family and friends. I make sure that I have contact with them each week. And as that improved, I found that I was then able to really focus on a new career, and this new career became writing the book. And what I found was really interesting. When I did change that emphasis, I just became so incredibly productive. I just had a clarity that I've never had before. I was really able to focus on the important things.
On Life Matters today, our guests are Graeme Cowan, who's author of a new book on the experience of depression, especially recovering from depression. It's called Back from the Brink, Australians Tell Their Stories of Overcoming Depression. And also John Brogdon, who's been through this. He's the former leader of the opposition in New South Wales and now chief executive of Manchester Unity. Interesting to hear what worked for you, Graeme. What worked for you, John?
It's very interesting just commenting on one point that Graeme made before I answer your question. Gee, some habits die hard, don't they? That's what I'm still in politics, you know, not answering your question directly. But Graeme makes the point about physical fitness. And yep. Physical fitness and mental fitness are very, we don't use the word mental fitness, but we use the word physical fitness. But they're very linked. I mean, if your mental state's edgy, then you shouldn't knock yourself about in a physical sense. You shouldn't drink too much. You shouldn't eat too much of what you shouldn't eat. So they are very linked. And it's interesting in Graeme's book, which is outstanding, a number of the people, like John Conrad's a very famous Australian former Olympian.
And not a man you would have thought wasn't getting enough exercise.
No, but exercise is part of his life. And a lot of the people that were interviewed, for them, exercise is a critical part of their life. For me, I mean, I guess I've had a number of people say to me, do you think politics is a profession that brings on depression? I don't know that it does. I guess the big difference for me, probably the big difference between Graeme and me, is that what happened to me happened very publicly. Mm. What happened to Graeme happened reasonably privately. I mean, although it's all relative. I mean, you know, you still have to face up to your friends and your people who you do work with and you used to work with and say to them, I'm depressed, I can't work, or I'm suffering, you know, I've got a tough time. So for me, it was very public. I went into a clinic in northern Sydney. I spent in total 3 weeks there. That was at first unbelievably frightening because I thought, you know, what am I doing? Not what is John Brogdon oppositionally, but what am I doing? What am I doing in a mental health clinic? I was on suicide watch for 3 weeks. I then came home after that, and that adjustment's not easy. You know, you mm-hmm. hear the phrase institutionalisation. Let me tell you, you can become institutionalised after 2 weeks. You just get very used to your routine and being looked after and handled. And then it was just adjusting back to the real world. For me, in the early stages, I couldn't walk down the street without looking people. I couldn't look people in the eye. So it took me a long time to adjust just simply back to social discourse. People would, because I was a public figure, people would come up and share their stories with me. It's amazing.
People wanted to wish you well.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable generosity in the community.
But it still may not be the easiest thing to deal with.
No. Although the one thing I will say, and I'm sure Graeme knows this as well, it's a very big club. You know, it's a very big club. There are a hell of a lot of people who suffer from depression. And the very positive message that comes out of Graeme's book, Graeme's experience, my experience, the experience of many people, and this is a very important message, John, to people who are listening today who might be suffering from depression, who might think they're suffering from depression, who know they're suffering from depression. You can come through the other side. You really can come through the other side. Both Graeme and I have been in such a hole, in such a place of despair that, and Graeme used the phrase burden. It's exactly right. I thought we were such a burden that people were better off without us. Now, it's a remarkable thing to say when you're the father, when you're a husband and the father, because most people would think that doesn't make any sense. How could you be walking away from somebody? But you are convinced, quite rationally, I found, Graham, in a bizarre way, that that was the best thing that I had.
It's not logical, but it's rational within the mindset you're in.
It's, well, the one thing I will say, I had absolute clarity of thought. Clarity of thought. I mean, I look back and think, how could it be? But absolute clarity of thought. To the people who are listening, who are on the way down or who are at the bottom, hopefully, looking at the way out, there is a way through this. There is a great message of hope. Put your hand out. Ask for the help. The help does exist. This is not a political message, but the current government in the last 6 months has allowed psychologists to receive the Medicare rebate. So it used to only be psychiatrists. There are much fewer psychiatrists than psychologists. So a lot of people literally couldn't afford to see people. Yeah. They couldn't afford to see a psychiatrist.
That, you had the 3 weeks in the place.
Yes,
in Sydney, and then what after that? There must have been something ongoing.
Absolutely. It took me a while to go to medication. The original view was that maybe I wasn't depressed. Maybe it was just a one-off instance. And after about 6 months, the view of my doctor was that it was. And the good thing, he was reluctant to put me on medication. It wasn't a case of saying, go take this pill once a day, go home, you'll be fine. It was, in fact, the reverse. I want to know that this is the right way to go. So I've tried two medications. The second one is more effective than the first one. That's a daily medication. Like Graham, I may be medicated for the rest of my life. That doesn't bother me in the least. It is a big issue with a lot of blokes. They think, no, I don't want to take that bloody pill for the rest of my life. Counselling. And the thing for me, without a doubt, was the love and assistance and support of friends and family.
Mm.
Now, for people who don't have that, and there are lots of people who don't have that, there are organisations like Lifeline. There are many organisations that can help people through. For many people, they may have friends and family, but just can't bring themselves to tell their friends and family. They're too ashamed. They don't think they'll understand. So for me, it was a slow journey. It took me, I mean, it really was. It was almost like, not that I've had a significant operation, but I looked at people who have. It's almost like learning to walk again.
It's that kind of length of rehabilitation.
Absolutely. I needed a good 6 to 8 months of proper rehabilitation on my own terms. And yet, in the middle of it all, I didn't understand why I couldn't be back at work on Monday.
Mm. Graham Cowan, you've chosen leaders and high achievers like John Brogdon amongst us to tell their stories of depression. Why specifically those people?
I had two objectives when I wrote the book. The first was to make people feel less alone, so hopefully there'd be less stigma. And by having a full range of people there, I felt that there would be someone there that everyone could relate to. There are high-profile people there like Jeff Gallup and John Conrads and Petria Thomas and the like, but there also are very everyday people as well. There are people that have had postnatal depression. There's Vietnam veterans that have suffered from post-traumatic stress. There's also people there that have suffered from horrendous sexual abuse and have overcome the depression that stemmed from that. So there's a full range of people. The second reason I wrote the book was really to provide hope. And each of those people have got an incredibly inspiring story. People have gone on after their depression and they've really reevaluated their life, but they've done incredible things. You know, there was a person recently, Brian Egan, who was featured on Australian Story, a man in catatonic depression. He couldn't even talk for about 3 months. Now he's running an organization called Aussie Helpers, which is out there in the bush helping farmers. Another lady, Leanne Pethick, a colleague committed suicide when she was at work, and she went on to found Depression Net, one of the busiest sites around.
It's interesting, isn't it, that part of the way of getting better and staying better is to be productive. It's to perhaps find something new or something else and to make it work.
Yeah.
But you've got to understand first, haven't you, Graham? You've got to understand what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
You can't sort of say, well, that didn't work, it must have been that job, I'm now going to go and be a butcher.
Yeah.
That's not going to work for you.
Yeah. So you've got to own it first.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
You have
to
own the problem. Well, Leanne Pethick, who founded this organisation called Depression Net and has spoken to thousands of depressed people over the years, she basically said is that the first step is taking responsibility for your own recovery, not taking a pill and expecting the pill is going to be miraculous. It's taking a pill, but it's also doing things differently and, you know, committing to doing exercise, committing to, you know, reach out to family and friends, committing to reevaluating what you're doing in life.
John Brogdon, you've clearly done that, but you're still chief executive of a fairly large concern.
Yeah.
It's not like you've decided to go off and grow a few vegetables.
No.
There's anything wrong with that.
No, there's not. But I did get into the garden. I mean, interestingly enough, you know, you couldn't have paid me enough to mow the lawn most times. I mean, I'd do it happily, but I'd do it because I had to, not because I wanted to. You know, one stage during my period of not working when I was recovering, my wife wanted to know who kidnapped her husband and replaced her with this bloke who's interested in gardening. You know, but it's about getting some balance back in. I mean, I guess for me, I don't have the high profile and the high profile pressure that I used to have. I mean, in public life, in political life, you know, you not every moment, but, you know, so many of your moments are under analysis where, you know, and every mistake you make gets pilloried, whereas you make a mistake in business, they happen, there'll be 10,000 mistakes made in businesses in Australia today. Most of those people will learn from that and move on. You know, there'll be 5 mistakes made in politics and most of those people will have their nose rubbed in it for the day. So that makes life easier. But it's much more balance for me now. And I made the point before about understanding it. There are situations, and for instance, Brian Egan, who Graham spoke of before, you know, when things get tough for him, he goes bush.
Mm.
You know, I know when I'm sitting in a meeting that I'm not going to cope. I'm not going to enjoy this. There's something that is going to be uncomfortable for me, and I will get up and walk out of the meeting. I said in a recent article that I'm on the board of the Private Health Insurance Industry Association. We had our annual conference last year, and the guest speaker was Jeff Kennett, who I know very well. Jeff was talking about Beyond Blue, and he stood there in, you know, true Jeff Kennett style and captured the audience and got his mobile phone out and started reading a text message from a woman whose child had just committed suicide, and he read it. And it was a very, very heavy message, very heavy story, and I had to get up and go. I just thought, no, I can't, I really can't. I mean, there were 200 people in the room. It wasn't as if I was missed, but I thought, I can't handle this, and I had to get up and walk out. And I don't know whether Graham, you feel that as well, but there are some things you don't do. So it's knowing what you like, what you don't like. In that sense, it's no different than, and I don't want to diminish in any sense. In fact, what I want to do is make it more practical for people, make depression more practical. It's no different from somebody who's got diabetes. You know what you can't eat.
Yeah.
If you've got diabetes, you don't eat those things. If you do, you'll have a bad night or a bad couple of days.
The interesting thing about that approach is it completely takes the stigma out of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's important. Isn't it? That's an important part of it, Graham.
Yeah. I'm very much like John as well. There's times when I recognise that I'm feeling tense or stressed or anxious, and I just pull back and say, well, you know, have I meditated today? Have I walked today? And I do that. And whereas in the past, I would have driven myself on. I would have really put the nose down and said, you can do it. But I just realised that if you've got a predisposition to it, you've got to be ever vigilant and you've got to be aware of the warning signs.
You sum up a lot of the research on what helps people find, what I guess helps most people or most people find most effective. Can you give us a very brief summary of what that is?
Yeah, well, when I started writing the book, I did an online survey through DepressionNet, and I asked people to rate what they found most successful in helping them overcome depression. And the top 5 were, number 5 was relaxation and meditation. Number 4 was a fulfilling career, which is really interesting. Mm. And having been a recruiter myself for 15 years, I know that a lot of people aren't happy in their work.
Mm.
Number 3 is counselling, be it cognitive behavioural therapy or interpersonal therapy or one of the therapies. Number 2 is support of family and friends. You know, having that network around you is just essential when you're not feeling great. And number 1 is exercise, which also coincided with a much, much larger research study done by the Black Dog Institute, where they found exercise to be the most important thing as well. And a full copy of that research, of both researchers, is on the website, which is iambackfromthebrink.com.
It's interesting, John, if I might, that...
it's Richard, but never
Richard,
mind.
I'm sorry, if I might, that Graham makes the point about... you made the point, Richard, about stigma. And, you know, I've been lucky. I've not, to my face or in my presence or in my surrounds, suffered any discrimination, without which to get melodramatic, any of the stigma of depression. I think there is some stigma, but I think the greatest thing is misunderstanding. And I don't want to say ignorance, because ignorance is such a loaded word. Mm. And, it's a negative word. I mean, it's such as its connotation.
Sort of lack of knowledge, if you like.
Yeah, there is a lack of knowledge. There's an absolute lack of knowledge. I mean, many people in a workplace today, if somebody walked into their boss and said, listen, I've just discovered I have depression, many bosses would say, oh, my God, what? In their mind, they'd be thinking, oh, what can I... Gee, can that person do their job? Can they work 5 days a week? Mm. Can they make that decision? Can they handle that piece of machinery? What does this mean? Should I sack them? Should I pay them out? Should I get rid of them? I mean, whereas if somebody walked in and said, listen, I've got a melanoma, blah, 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 the boss would say, oh, no problems. And what's the doctor say? Oh, righty-o, you need 2 weeks off. Fine. Bang. Mm. See you in 2 weeks.
Mm. Yeah.
And we need to get to a point where the same view is taken about depression. Yeah. And there's a lot of... there's a lot of understanding that needs to take place before that happens. Jeff Gallup is interesting on this, and I've written to Jeff, and obviously he's been interviewed by Graham for the book, but recently Jeff said if he understood how he could live and deal and cope with depression, he may never have resigned. Mm. And that's interesting, but I've made this statement once or twice before. When Jeff Gallup got up, I think in January 2006, and made his press statement, and about depression and needing to resign to recover. If he had got up and said, listen, I've got, God forbid, I've got prostate cancer. My doctors tell me I've got an excellent chance of recovery. I'm fit and healthy, but I need 6 or 12 months off. So-and-so is the acting premier while I'm away, and when I'm back, when I recovered, I'll take my full responsibilities again. As extraordinary as that would have been, I am confident the majority of Western Australians, the majority of Australians would have said, oh, fine, no problems. Mm. He should be allowed a chance to get better. Mm. If he'd said, I'm suffering depression, my doctors tell me with a bit of time off and medication and advice and counselling, et cetera, I will get better, I'll be back in 6 or 12 months. I just don't know how people would have coped.
Yeah.
And that's until we can have somebody in a position of authority treat a mental illness of that sort the way they would treat a physical illness, then I think we haven't achieved what we need to achieve. So Graham's book is an outstanding addition to greater understanding in Australia about how people live with depression, what they suffer, but there is a message of hope you can come out the other end.
Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in today. Our guests have been John Brogdon, who's the former leader of the opposition in New South Wales, now chief executive of Manchester Unity and patron of Lifeline in New South Wales, and also Graham Cowan, who's author of Back from the Brink, Australians Tell Their Stories of Overcoming Depression. It's published this week by Bird in Hand Media. I want to remind everybody listening of the number for Lifeline, and that is 1311 14. If you go to the Life Matters website, which is abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters, there are lots of resources there to help with depression. You are with Life Matters on ABC Radio National. You can hear us twice a day, 9 in the morning, 9 at night, and you can download the audio of the program from our website.